cracked, but it wasn't broken. Bunny had the duct tape out, and as I held Andrea, he crisscrossed the visor with the waterproof and airproof tape. Ho stood watching, his gun pointed down. I pivoted on my knees. Move that barrel right goddamn now. Ho hesitated, and I slapped the barrel high and left, and then Belle was there coming out of nowhere. She kicked Ho in the back of the knees, and as he dropped, she slapped, turned him, and took his rifle away, handing it to me. Then she straddled him, and suddenly her fighting knife was in her hand. Belle took a fistful of cloth in one hand and laid the razor-sharp edge against it.
Do I cut?
She asked in a voice that was eerily calm. Ho froze, not even sure he breathed.
Stay,
ordered Belle. Then to Bunny, she said,
cuffs.
Bunny produced more zip ties, but instead of cuffing Ho, he cinched them securely around Andrea's wrists and ankles. And for good measure, he hogtied him, rolling him onto his stomach and using a third zip tie to connect wrists to ankles. If Andrea turned, he would not be attacking anyone.
Sorry, brother,
he said, and laid a palm flat on Andrea's shoulder. Top looked at his timer.
How long?
I asked.
Jeeves was 13 seconds,
said Top. We waited. I heard Andrea praying, not in Italian, but in Latin, an old-fashioned prayer to the Virgin Mary. Ho stayed where he was because Belle did not move that knife. The moment seemed to stretch, to pull so tight the world had to break.
12, said Top, measuring it out in a slow, steady voice. 13, 14, 15.
He counted all the way to 30. To 60. Andrea kept praying. When Top counted his way through 2 full minutes, I said, Belle. She unclenched her fist and smoothed the material of Ho's suit, gave him a little pat, then stepped back. She did not put the knife away, nor did she apologize. We stood there, waiting. 4 minutes. 5. No one said a goddamn word until 10 full minutes passed. I tapped back into the talk. How are his numbers?
Pulse is off the charts, said Doc. But that's consistent with being scared out of his goddamn mind. Your own pulse is just as high.
No shit, I said. Mr. Church spoke quietly.
Jackpot stays bound. Prepare for exfil. This mission is over.
It sounded great. Those were the words we wanted to hear, even though we all knew, every single one of us, that it was not true. Whatever this was, had just begun. Chapter 53. Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. His name was Jerome Leroy Williams, but known to everyone as Bug. Even his mother used to call him that. His smiling face filled the big screen in Mr. Church's office.
What have you got for me?
Asked Church. He was nibbling a vanilla wafer. A silver plate of them sat beside his laptop.
Been playing with the videos and having some fun.
Define fun.
Bug had Coke bottle glasses and very long hair that he'd recently started wearing in long twists with a sculpted fade. The t-shirt he wore had a photoshopped picture of him and Lupita Nyong'o getting married, with T'Challa presiding.
I ran the video of the ROK guys and the SEALs through a bunch of filters and came up with something cool,
said Bug.
I isolated a track that I think is the sound of the person taking the video breathing. From the degree of hiss distortion, it sounds like the person is breathing right next to a long-distance mic, trying not to be heard, but it's a good mic if it picked up conversation from the beach. Listen.
He played the track and Church closed his eyes.
Play it again, he said.
When it was finished, he opened his eyes and said,
It's a woman.
Yep. The timbre rings, the bells is female, and my sound guys all tell me that she's probably young, late teens to early 30s. Want me to explain how they came up with that?
No. What else do you have?
There's a second breathing pattern that's also close, but not as close to the mic. A guy, maybe the same age or a little older. Stronger breath and more controlled, less stress in the rhythm.
He played it, and Church nodded.
This is good.
There's more.
Bug was clearly very happy. He loved his job, and it showed. When he was a teenager, Bug got into trouble for hacking his school's computer. And then he compounded it by hacking Homeland, the CIA, and several branches of military intelligence. Bug had been trying to find Bin Laden. Church offered him a choice between prison or a chance to work with the world's most sophisticated computer system to do some measurable good. Some years later, Bug actually helped locate Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. Proof that all he needed was the right computer. That system was one owned exclusively by Church. Mind Reader. The Mind Reader system was designed to intrude into virtually any kind of computer, bypassing security and rewriting the target computer's software to erase all traces of the hack. All other intrusion computers leave a scar, but Mind Reader does not. Over the years, Bug upgraded this system several times, most recently merging it with the first truly workable quantum computer, and backed that up with the Calpurnia Artificial Intelligence Software System. The result is a computer now called Mind Reader Q1 that works faster than anyone else's by a couple of orders of magnitude. "I tore the punk press thing apart," said Bug. "They were very, very careful to hide the location of where it was sent from. There are some scrambler devices on the market, well, mostly the black tech market, that use cyclical 128-bit coding algorithms to bounce everything around so much the source gets buried in its own back trail."
"But," prompted Church.
"Well, if this was the only time Punk Press sent out one of these emails, then we'd be nowhere. You can't find a pattern from a single instance."
Church chewed his cookie and waited.
"What I did is search for all Punk Press uploads across the net and the dark net and came up with 154 separate posts."
Bug took a sip from a can of Monster.
"The first few posts were less well concealed. I mean, they fooled Interpol and some white hat hackers hired to track it down. But, you know, this is me. I tore apart the emails and put Q1 on a pattern search and found the original 16-digit computer ID for the sender. The ID tagged the machine as a Dell XPS 13, which is one of the most popular models sold in Malaysia. Now, I know you'll say that model is sold in a lot of countries, but when we backtracked those first messages, there were three with source points at cyber cafes in Kuala Lumpur. So, we have four uploads with computer IDs from popular laptops in Malaysia and three actual posts sent from Kuala Lumpur. All seven of those are the seven original posts by Punk Press."
Bug shrugged.
"After that, they got tricky. But I'd bet my mint issue of Fantastic Four number 52 signed by Stan Lee that one or both of the people doing the heavy breathing on the video are from Malaysia."
"Good work, Bug," said Church, meaning it.
"No, wait, there's more," said Bug happily. "I also had some fun with the email sent to the South Korean ambassador. They used a scrambler on that too, but it's a different model. Pretty sure it's one of the portable kind that a lot of these WikiLeaks wannabes have been using. Good. But not good enough."
Church tapped crumbs off his cookie.
"Stop showing off, Bug, and tell me what you found."
Bug was completely unabashed.
"That email did not come from Malaysia. I did some noodling, ran a few of my special programs, and I can say with like a 99% certainty that it came from South Korea."
"That is not happy news, Bug."
"Not as such, no, but I've been able to eliminate the possibility that it was sent from any of the military bases there. They have uniquely configured firewalls, and
can you find out from where in South Korea it was sent?"
"Maybe. I haven't narrowed down to the Gyeongsangnam-do region."
"It's my belief that there are several million people living in that region, Bug," said Church.
"I'm working on narrowing it down," said Bug. "It takes time."
"Time is not our friend," said Church.
"I might do better on the ground there. I can take a team and we can..."
"Go," said Church. Bug grinned and was gone.
Chapter 54. The Lab, in international waters 25 nautical miles from North Korea, Sea of Japan. The barge was big and flat and full of people who looked like the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man from that old Ghostbusters movie. White or yellow hazmat suits, each with its own air tanks. Lots of bulky equipment.
Lots of people with guns, too. And 4 tower-mounted flamethrowers aimed at a dedicated quarantine space on one end. The exfiltration chopper had been a bulky Chinook that lowered a metal box like a shipping container. We could not risk using the RHIB to come out here because it couldn't be easily sterilized. So, once we were all in the container and lifting off, I triggered its self-destruct mechanism. It's now a lump of unidentifiable slag. The container they lowered was, in fact, a high-end biohazard unit. We put the zippered corpses into a cold box and put Sergeant Chung and a very nervous Andrea into isolation cubicles. The drone was isolated in a big plastic box. Havoc team was strapped into seats with our hammer suits on and sealed while the Chinook flew us to the barge. No one spoke much, though I switched to a secure channel directly to the talk. Because the hoods of the hammer suits are not completely soundproof, I was careful about what I said and mostly gave them observers' impressions to enhance the telemetry and video feeds from the drones. On the other hand, Doc and Church were free to be as chatty as they wanted. For Church, that wasn't very much. Doc, on the other hand, is a horse of a different color. She asked about 1,000 questions. She asked about skin color and lividity for both the dead and the little girl prior to her death. She had me verify that the girl spoke. This seemed to bother her quite a lot, and she asked me to go over the scene moment by moment. "It was all on the video," I said. "You can watch the playback."
"You were on the ground, honey cheeks," she said.
Doc is like that. She is about a standard light year away from being politically correct, and yet her comments never felt all that insulting. Not sure why. I'd need to get Rudy to decode it for me.
"Tell it to me the way you saw it. Give me all of it, darling. Put me in the moment."
And so I did. I closed my eyes and was back there on the village street, and I told her everything. She did not interrupt. When I was done, she let out a long, sad sigh.
"I'll get back to you," she said, unhelpfully.
I omitted the conversation I'd had with Ho. That would be something to share with Church later on. The Chinook lowered the biohazard unit onto the barge with only a mild thump, then dropped the cables and flew off. The WHO team, supplemented by hot zone veterans from all 4 countries, closed around us, blasting the outside of the unit with high-pressure sprays that were designed to kill any living thing, even prions, which are notoriously hard to kill. Then they connected hoses to ports and flooded the inside of the unit with a gas mixture that would do the same. If we weren't sealed into our suits, we'd have died along with the viruses, bacteria, fungi, and other unwanted travelers. They coupled a flexible plastic tunnel to the airlock, sealed it, sprayed the seal, and signaled us to disarm the inside security locks. We walked through the tunnel into a holding chamber that had sanitation cubicles for each of us. They sprayed and sprayed and sprayed, and then we stripped down to our skin and they sprayed us some more. Although I could hear the sprays hitting the other Havoc team members in adjoining cubicles, it somehow made me feel incredibly alone. Maybe this is what it felt like to go through decontamination on the International Space Station. It was not a comforting feeling, in any way. Everything I wore, including all of my equipment, went into a small container that had automatic locks. It sank into the floor for conveyor belt transport to a holding area. Later, it would be studied, as everything was studied, to isolate whatever pathogen caused this. And after that, the stuff would likely be incinerated. I put on the clothes they left for me, underwear and coveralls made from some kind of plastic that was supposed to feel like soft cotton, but which utterly failed to do so. Weirdly, they piped music into the cubicle the whole time. Smooth jazz. I'm not sure if it was intended to soothe the nerves, but if I had a hammer, I'd have smashed the shit out of the speakers. It took 2.5 hours before they let us out. A lot can happen in so short a space of time. Chapter 55. Goseong Dinosaur Museum, 18 Jaran Man Ro, Haimyeon, Goseong-gun,
Gyeongsangnam-do, South Korea. An Il-tan finished her work for the museum, then spent another hour checking all of the news services for some word of the massacre on Gaegyul-isyom. There was nothing on the net. She engaged her scrambler and accessed the dark web. That was always a risk. The dark web was invisible to most of the World Wide Web. Its contents were not indexed by any standard search engines. You had to know how to find specific sites in order to get anywhere, and those HTTP forms were carefully masked. The sites she wanted were also hidden behind paywalls, but Anil had enough cryptocurrency stored to pay the fees. She'd earned some of the digital funds by selling information on the Silk Road online black market. Her goods were not drugs, which is what comprised most of the commodities sold on Silk Road, but bulk data stolen from corrupt businesses. Data was currency in her world. She entered the right passwords and went through some verification steps, and then she was in. There was one very useful site called Rat Nest, which was wired into channels used by the CIA, Interpol, and other groups. She posted some vaguely worded questions asking if anything juicy was happening in the two Ks, shorthand for North and South Korea. But there was nothing newer than 61 hours ago, and that was a nothing thing about a defector claiming he had photographic proof of human rights violations. Nothing that related to the Island of Frogs. She chewed her lip. Was no news a good thing? Did that mean the ambassador was actually working on this? Trying to put the pin back into the grenade, so to speak? Or had she been naive and helped the South Koreans and Americans cover up a crime? Chapter 56. The Lab, 25 nautical miles from North Korea, Sea of Japan. I learned that the barge was nicknamed simply The Lab. Bet it took a committee 6 weeks and a few hundred emails to come up with that. Dr. John Smarr, the director of the floating team of mad scientists, was a thin, angular guy with steel-rimmed glasses, a black ponytail, and short beard. He looked like the kind of cool professor kids would relate to in college, but there was a cold anger in his eyes if you looked close. He'd seen firsthand some of the horrors that governments, terrorist groups, and rogue scientists have cooked up as WMDs. And he's worked on a bunch of DMS cases that had broken his heart and stoked his fury. When he saw me come out of my sterilization cubicle, he smiled and came forward, offering his hand. Not to shake, but as a fist bump. Guys who work around diseases tend to go for the more antiseptic bump. "Tell me you've already figured this out," I said, "and that there's an easy cure that will allow me and my guys to go home, drink beer, get laid, and be happy." John pursed his lips and gave me a long, assessing look, then pretended to dictate examination notes.
"So, the patient presented with symptoms consistent with delusional behavior, possibly a deep-seated psychosis. I'm recommending heavy doses of clozapine and four-point restraints."
"I'm a living weapon, you know," I said. "My hands are knives, my legs are swords. I could chop you into sushi."
"I could have you locked in the quarantine cube for 72 hours and pipe in nothing but Nickelback's greatest hits," he countered.
"Touché."
"Come on, I have coffee," said John, gesturing to a structure like a double-wide trailer at the far end of the barge. "And it's real coffee, too, not the... Wait, what is it you call decaf?"
"Brown sadness water."
"Right, this is definitely not that."
And it wasn't. The coffee he brewed was so manly that halfway through my first cup, I wanted to chop wood while wearing a checked flannel shirt. Rudy would have hated it. The trailer was, in fact, a house trailer, bolted to the deck. Three others were set behind it, each marked as BSL-4, Biosafety Level 4, which was only used for the direst biological threats. Through the reinforced glass windows of those, I could see technicians in hazmat suits. John led me to the only one marked with a much less scary BSL-1, two-thirds of which was a lab with a cramped kitchen in the back.
"To answer your question, Joe,"
he said as he slid into the booth across from me. No, we don't have an answer. I spoke at length with Doc Holliday. We have lots of theories, but nothing concrete, which means we don't have a protocol. Not a ghost of one, beyond erring on the side of maximum security precautions. You saw the video of how fast Sergeant Chung turned? I did, John said, shaking his head. I've never seen anything work that fast, not even Saif al-Din. It's freakishly fast, which is suggestive.
Suggestive of what? That we're in the sequel to 28 Days Later?
There already was a sequel to that, he said. It sucked. No. What I mean is that it's suggestive of existing exposure. We're testing Chung now to see if he was previously exposed to something that was triggered on the island.
Like the super rabies thing?
Possibly.
What about the drone?
I've got a team on that. Too risky to ship it to Doc Holliday until we know more. So far, all we've determined is that it's a drone.
Oh, very useful.
We're doing metallurgic and materials testing. That may give us point of origin, said John. As for the tank mounted beneath it, it's weird. It has a big fan behind a screen with a very tight mesh. Whatever was inside was clearly blown out through the tube mounted beneath. We don't know what was ejected, though, and unfortunately, the tank is contaminated.
By what?
Flies. Nasty, persistent little bastards. The whole village was swarming with them. Drawn by the onset of decay, no doubt.
Why would they climb into the tank? I asked.
We're working on that, he said. Could be that there was some component in whatever was discharged that drew them. Something with a sugar base, perhaps. But that's just speculation, Joe. We don't really know anything.
So, I said, any horseback guess as to what we're dealing with?
Offhand? Mused John. It beats the living shit out of me. It's not a drug, and so far we haven't found an active virus or bacterium. No mycotoxins either. It acts like a chemical imbalance, but that's hard as hell to induce in a group of people. Age and gender differences alone make that tough. And besides, it acted on Sergeant Chung like something airborne. We are processing the samples and sharing that data with labs around the world. There are a lot of people working on this, Joe, and Doc Holliday has her people on it. He gave a wry chuckle. I'm not actually sure there has ever been a larger or more aggressive coordination of medical research focused so quickly on a single biological threat.
Church, I suggested.
Church. We had more coffee. He opened a fridge and gave me a wrapped sandwich, which was supposed to be egg salad. It tasted like ass. We ate.
How come it didn't register on the BAMS units? I asked.
Add that to the list of questions that need answering.
Maybe it's not a virus, I suggested. Maybe it's some kind of genetic stuff. Couldn't transgenics or CRISPR or that stuff make people go all wonky?
He grinned. God, I love it when you demonstrate your incisive grasp of the realities of science.
Bite me. You're saying it's not that?
Genetic manipulation can accomplish significant changes, including radical behavioral changes, but not quickly. Not like this. Gene editing isn't something you can fit into a pill, Joe, so
no. What if it was some variation on the rabies thing? Genetic manipulation controlled by nanites?
He was shaking his head before I even finished. No, not a chance. The speed of onset and the uniformity of reactions are the keys here, and right now they're not unlocking any useful doors.
Well, fuck, I said.
Without a doubt, he agreed.
The one good thing, I began, then stopped and tried it a different way. None of this is good, but the only thing that is the closest to a break we got here is that this happened on a tiny island far away from the mainland.
How is that lucky? It seems obvious that this bioweapon was delivered to the island, which means that someone has more of it.
True, and my job will be to find those people, I said. But it seems pretty obvious that the goal here is to either start a war or destabilize the region. They chose this place pretty carefully.
knowing what the political ramifications would be. It could have been much worse.
Or they were test driving it, he suggested.
I shook my head. You don't need a team of phony baloney Navy SEALs for that. No, man, this was a strike. Deliberate, calculated, and successful.
John leaned back, sipping his coffee, and studied me with his dark eyes. Then he abruptly stood up. Then I'd better get back to work.
Interlude 12. Hyatt Regency, 1000 Boulevard of the Arts, Sarasota, Florida, 10 months ago. They sat together in the dark. Adam and Eve snuggled together on a big chaise longue, and Daddy sat on a rattan chair with a huge fan back. The table between them was littered with wine bottles and glasses and spent joints in a ceramic dish. The boats in the marina thumped gently against their fenders. The staff left them alone because everyone who mattered on the night shift belonged to Daddy. Eve said a name out loud. She said his name, Daddy's real name.
Rafael Santoro.
Eve pronounced each syllable, making the Spanish name seem wonderfully exotic.
Rafael Santoro.
Yes, he said, beaming at her, and at Adam.
This is a great sign of my trust, yes? To know my name means that I indeed trust you. Do you understand?
Adam licked his lips, then nodded. Eve continued to smile like a happy child on Christmas morning.
And, continued Santoro, I know your names, the ones you each left behind.
They nodded. It had terrified them when he first revealed that he'd managed to uncover what they each thought they'd erased from the world. At the same time, it was somehow exciting that Daddy was that powerful, that smart. He was their father now.
Will you tell us who Kuga is?
Asked Eve. Santoro pursed his lips, then shook his head.
That is not my secret to tell. But besides children, how do you know Kuga is a single person? He could be many men or women. He could be 1,000 people all using that name. You called him he,
said Adam.
When you told us about him, you always use male pronouns.
Santoro gave a small shrug.
I could be saying that for convenience sake, or as a distraction. For all you know, I could be Kuga.
They frowned.
But you're not, said Eve slowly. Are you?
Santoro laughed. No, my sweet girl, I am not Kuga.
When do we get to meet him?
Asked Adam. Daddy sipped his wine.
When and if he decides to allow it. Why is he so cagey, though?
Complained Adam.
It's not like we're likely to tell anyone.
Daddy shrugged.
It isn't about what you will or won't do, he said. It is all about what he wants. Well, if we're not going to meet him, then why are we here?
Asked Eve.
Ah, said Daddy, nodding as if it was the question he'd been waiting for.
He reached into his jacket pocket and set 2 thumb drives on the table. It was a peculiar habit of his never to hand things directly to them.
You will find your next assignment on there. Details, identities, account numbers, physical papers for travel will be delivered to you at the appropriate time.
Travel?
Daddy smiled.
Neither of you has ever been out of the country, yes? We will change that. There are some things you will need to do here in the States, and then you will take up residence in Tokyo.
We're going to Japan?
Asked Eve, suddenly excited.
Yes, among other places. A language coach will be in touch. You will need to acquire some basic conversational Japanese and Korean.
You will be diligent in your studies, so that you will not disappoint me.
I was never all that good with that stuff, said Eve. They made me study French.
Daddy shrugged.
Whichever of you comes along most quickly will be the point person for certain aspects of the operation. The other will be backup and have other tasks.
What's the operation? Asked Adam. Daddy sipped his wine.
We're going to make a lot of people very angry, he said quietly.
Chapter 57 Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. Tony Kim loved the place. Yeonpyeong Island had history. It had drama. It was going to make a hell of a location for his movie.
It's frigging gorgeous, he kept saying, to his location scout, to the cinematographer, and to the scriptwriter. None of them were Korean. None of them thought the place was exceptionally pretty, or interesting, or convenient. Tony figured that you had to have Korean blood to have the right kind of insight.
It's less than 3 square miles big, said the location scout named Hector, a mousy little guy who looked like Peter Lorre, except that no one knew who Peter Lorre was anymore. That broke Tony's heart, because Peter Lorre would have loved this place, too.
It's self-contained, said Tony.
It's a fucking shoebox, complained Hector. How do you expect me to find enough location angles to make this look like Seoul?
We'll green screen some of it if we have to.
The screenwriter rubbed his fingers together in the time-honored way that indicated money. He did it every time Tony made a suggestion like that. Somewhere back in L.A., a line producer was breaking out in hives because shooting here was going to pop the cherry on the budget, which was the opposite of the actual point. The reason they weren't shooting on the mainland was the skyrocketing cost. Yeonpyeong was supposed to be much cheaper, which would allow them to put more cash into casting and special effects. CGI dinosaurs did not come cheap. Not good ones, anyway. And they wanted someone topping the credits who the general public had at least heard of. A solid B-lister, but someone who'd won an award for something somewhere. Like Cuba Gooding Jr., who had an Oscar. It would allow Tony to shout the phrase Academy Award winner in the press releases for the rest of his life. That was the plan. The screenwriter, Noah Bixby, was trying to hold on to his optimism that there was at least a Cuba Gooding Jr. still in the budget. His optimism kept slipping gears, though. They were tooling around in a golf cart owned by the Board of Tourism. Said board shared a storefront with the post office and a little company that wrote copy for mainland tourist brochures. They had only the one golf cart, and it looked to be about 40 years old. For some reason no one could adequately explain, it had a picture of Donald Duck on the hood. Not a drawing, an actual photograph of someone dressed as Donald Duck. The picture was affixed to the hood with some kind of decoupage.
The people are nice, though, said Gerhardt, the cinematographer, who was a cheerful German with a shaved head and twinkling blue eyes. He was one of those people who smiled at everyone and everything. Tony loved him for that. But the location scout suspected Gerhardt's optimism came out of a pill bottle. Whatever. Gerhardt was an artist. The documentary he showed at Tribeca won awards. The indie films he did with Julie Delpy had everyone crying at Sundance. Granted, those flicks made pocket change in limited runs in a few art houses, but they were art. Real art. Now, Gerhardt was here to film Koreanosaurus, and if Noah Bixby wasn't Derek Connolly or Jordan Peele, then who cared? He could write his ass off. They rolled along the streets in the golf cart, sometimes doubling back so Hector could take some digital shots of good angles. He liked acting as his own location scout and often micromanaged the cinematography. He was everywhere, clicking pictures. The locals watched, amused. Everyone knew who they were and why they were here. It was no secret. Everyone liked the idea of American dollars flooding into the economy. Hector slapped at a biting fly on his forearm.
Got these old bastards to deal with, too, he complained.
Stop bitching, said Noah. Shoot a film in goddamn Alaska, and then you can talk. They got mosquitoes up there who'll pick you up and carry you off.
Yeah, whatever.
Hey, said Gerhard, can we stop for some lunch? I'm dying for some kimchi. We just passed a place.
Hector tapped his wristwatch and said,
light's going to be different by the time we're done.
So what? Said Gerhard. We're not actually filming, man, and I'm hungry. Tony, Noah, what about you guys?
I could eat, said Noah. You good, Tony?
Tony, though, was looking at something across the street.
That's weird, he said.
What?
Asked Gerhard, scanning the street to find the restaurant.
Look at that kid.
What kid?
Asked Hector, who was still focused on finding locations and wasn't really looking.
What's wrong with him?
Said Tony.
Hmm?
Murmured Hector distractedly. He had a small lens with a frame inside so he could view the street as it might appear on the screen.
By adjusting it, he could tighten focus. Maybe this wouldn't suck too bad. It was pretty, after all.
Jesus Christ! Cried Gerhard.
Hector looked up, annoyed, as Noah stopped the golf cart with a jerk.
The hell, man?
His words trailed off into nothing because nothing he could say would make sense of the moment. Across the street, a few doors from the noodle shop, was a boy, 10 or 11, dressed in jeans and a Ninja Turtles t-shirt. He was eating something that looked like a big, sloppy sandwich, something covered in too much hot sauce. Except, that wasn't what it was. Hector and Tony, Noah and Gerhard, all knew it wasn't, but none of them could force themselves to accept what it was. Because this was the real world, and what they were looking at belonged to the kind of movies they made. Monster movies. Horror flicks.
No,
said Noah.
God,
said Gerhard. Hector turned aside and vomited into the street. Tony Kim just sat and stared. The boy held an arm, forearm, and what was left of a hand. Tony couldn't process it. He could not even blink. This wasn't special effects. This wasn't a rubber prop smeared with food coloring, corn syrup, and chocolate sauce. This wasn't that. This wasn't that. What made it worse, what made it impossible, was that people walked past him and did not even glance his way, as if the child and his grisly feast existed in some parallel dimension, as if it was on a TV screen in a Best Buy and they were shopping for something else. That rooted them all to their seats. It was wrong in more ways than Tony Kim could calculate.
I don't,
began Hector.
I don't.
He didn't finish his sentence because in the very next second he screamed as Gerhard, still smiling, leaned over and took a big red bite out of Hector's cheek. He did it suddenly. His shriek was so sharp, so loud, so awful that it froze the whole street for one moment. Then the passers-by seemed to be punched out of their mute indifference to what was happening. They stopped and turned, not toward the boy, but toward the men in the golf cart. Noah and Tony were shocked to immobility. Hector shrieked, and Gerhard, no longer smiling, began punching him. Short, hard, vicious punches to the face, the throat, the eye, the chest. The skin on Gerhard's fists ruptured and burst. The bones in his hands cracked and shattered. He kept punching, though. Which is when all of the people on the street threw back their heads and screamed, like a flock of furious birds, like a pack of hyenas. High, throat-ripping shrieks of pure, unfiltered, towering fury. Then they broke into a run. One moment they were still, and the next instant they were in full mad flight, tearing across the street toward the golf cart. Tony and Noah did not try to run. Noah didn't start the cart. No, because by then they were screaming too, in madness, in rage. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea, Part 4. Hell has three gates, lust, anger, and greed. The Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 58.
Sacheon Airport, Gyeongsangnam-do, South Korea.
Mr. Bug?
The woman wore an official uniform and a tentative smile.
Just Bug.
They stood on a windy tarmac. The woman met him at the foot of the jet's fold-down stairs. Two hulking soldiers stood by an SUV parked 40 feet away. She introduced herself as Lieutenant Annie Han and stuck out a hand, and Bug shook it. He figured she had to be at least in her early 20s to have an officer's rank in the Republic of Korea Army, but Han looked like she was 14. Tiny body, huge eyes, and obvious nervousness.
"I'm honored to meet you, sir,"
she said as they walked toward the SUV.
"Really? Why?"
Han looked surprised.
"You're him."
"Not following."
"You're Cold Tiger."
Bug jerked to a stop and cut her a sharp look.
"What did you say?"
Han flushed a sudden and furious red. She leaned close and dropped her voice to a hushed and confidential tone.
"On the dark web. You're Cold Tiger. I'm right, aren't I?"
"What makes you think that?"
I've been studying you for years."
"Wait, what? Studying me?" She shifted so that her back was to the male soldiers, and using one finger drew a small half-circle in the air. An arc. Which is when Bug understood. This young Korean soldier was more than that. She was arc-light.
"My musician friend told me about you,"
said Han, and that was another code. Musician. Violin. Bug took a breath, then nodded. Very few people on Earth knew about his dark web persona. Cole Tiger, a name drawn from Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's original name for the character who became the Black Panther.
"Okay," he said uneasily, "but let's not sling that name around too much, okay? Bug is fine."
"Sure, sorry,"
she said, but stared at him with a fangirl glow that made him deeply uncomfortable. It was the way he probably looked when he met the actors from that movie at a private party in Brentwood. The soldiers opened the SUV doors. Once Bug and Han were settled in the back seat, she pushed a button that slid a heavy glass panel closed, sealing them in privacy.
"Soundproof,"
she said.
"You know I have to check you out, right?"
"Oh, sure."
Han did not seem offended in any way. Bug tapped his comms unit and cycled to a private channel. Mr. Church was waiting for him. Before Bug could even say much, Church said, "Lieutenant Han is in the family. Lilith gives her high marks, and she is very close friends with Violin."
"Okay," said Bug. "Good to know.
Her computer skills are such that if you decide to hire her, you have my full approval."
"Thanks."
He disconnected from the call, turned to Han, and smiled.
"Have you seen the punk press video?"
"I have. And I was told that it was likely sent from here."
"Good," he said.
"Then let's get to work." She nodded.
"You're my hero, you know? I'm not joking. You're the absolute coolest of the cool."
Bug's face was suddenly hot as flame. He mumbled.
"Thanks."
Han gave a musical laugh, punched him playfully on the arm, and pulled out her laptop. Chapter 59. The Lab, 25 nautical miles from North Korea, Sea of Japan. They let Andrea out of containment. His blood work was clean. So were his brain scans, CT, MRI, X-rays, and urinalysis. The clincher was when Smar's people tested his visor and determined that the cracks did not go all the way through. They tested it with gas, dyes, and high-pressure chemicals. The barrier between him and the pathogen was less than 3/100ths of an inch.
"You better go to church," said Top. "Thank baby Jesus for protecting your ass."
Andreas snorted.
"To hell with that," he said. "When we get back home, I'm going to cash in my retirement funds and buy as many Super NNL Lotto tickets as I can afford."
"Yeah," said Bunny. "That actually sounds like a good plan because you are officially the luckiest motherfucker I've ever met."
He offered his fist and Andrea bumped it. We all grinned at one another. Even Belle scowled less, which was her version of a smile. Then, John Smarr came pelting across the deck toward us, waving frantically.
"This is not going to be good,"
muttered Top. It wasn't. He yelled,
"There's been another incident!"
Andrea closed his eyes.
"Merda,"
he groaned.
"Say, mie amici, I'd be okay with going right back into isolation if it's all the same with you."
Chapter 60. In Flight Over South Korean Airspace. Yeonpyeong Island was on the other side of the Korean Peninsula, which meant we had to get there ASAP. The Chinook that brought us was the fastest way of getting there. Those big birds have a top speed of 195 miles per hour, and 195 was about the distance between where the lab floated and where the outbreak was happening. However, we couldn't go straight to the island. All of our gear was contaminated, and the hazmat suits on the lab were not suited for combat. We needed a full refit. But Church assured me that our logistics wizard, Bird Dog, was already at Osan, so we bundled into the Chinook and were wheels up before we'd finished buckling up. Ho wanted to come with us, and I agreed. Once we were in the air, though, I had to call Church to make sure he could finesse the clearance. The big man turned it over to Scott Wilson, and before you could say, "Kiss my ass," it was done. Now, if everything in government could work with that kind of common sense efficiency, we would be a happier species. Just saying. I went into the back and had a private conference call with Doc, Bug, who was in another part of Korea, and Church. The Chinook didn't have an orb function, so I put on VR goggles, and there they all were. Doc Holliday was dressed in a cowboy shirt that was about two sizes too small and embroidered with flowers and hummingbirds, bright blue horn-rimmed glasses, and shocking red lipstick. Her blonde hair was piled high, and there were a couple of novelty Harry Potter magic wands stuck in the bun. Don't ask. There was no humor or playfulness on her face, though. Beneath the makeup and concealer, she was drawn and pale.
"Before you ask," she said, "no, we don't know what it is yet."
I keep getting that answer, and it's not very damn useful, I groused.
"When we know, you'll know," she said. "For the moment, we need to proceed as if this is every bit as dangerous as it appears to be."
"Roger that," I glanced at Church. "What do we know about the new outbreak?" "The island has a population of 1,790 people, plus roughly 300 tourists, crews of fishing and commercial boats, and others. We believe that this disease has spread across the entire island." "Christ," I growled. "Is everyone already infected?"
"We don't think so," said Doc. "Police and military helicopters are in the air maintaining a safe distance, but from what we can see through long-range cameras, some people are fighting back or hiding. What matters most is that the infected are aggressive vectors. Any contact with them causes a rapid onset of symptoms."
"Serum transfer?" I asked.
"That's likely, but we can't rule out airborne. The infection rate is so weirdly fast that it's almost like just being in the presence of the infected does the trick. And that shouldn't be the case because cameras have picked up people getting infected while they are clearly outside of the range of exhalation, spitting, or sneezing. But we can't get close enough to understand how this spreads."
"Which is what you want us to do," I said.
"Yes," said Church. "We need to know what we're dealing with. We've never seen anything spread this fast before. And we need to know what the red line is in terms of how we approach containment."
His face was also haggard, and there was a deep sadness in the set of his mouth. He wears tinted glasses, so it's hard to read his expression, but from the tense set of his shoulders and the tightness of those frowning lips, I thought I read fear there. But I could be wrong. People always misunderstand Church. They see how strong and capable he is. They glimpse a towering intellect and a commanding nature, and they take from that a lack of emotion and a freedom from human reactions. That's not accurate, and it isn't fair. Church formed the DMS and the RTI because of fear. and anger. Those emotions are stoked by his deep understanding of the nature of the threats he asks his people to confront. Church has walked through the burning darkness way too often to be blasé about it. No, his outward calm in most situations is all game face. He needs to be the eye of a hurricane so that the people around him don't panic or lose faith, so that we don't falter in our resolve. The very first time I met him was when a terrorist group was releasing the Saif al-Din pathogen, though by the time he and I had our first conversation, the disease had already been released in a few select places. An infected terrorist had been brought to a hospital in Baltimore, and Church was on site when the infection began to spread. It spread so fast that one of his crack field teams was overrun, and then it swept like wildfire throughout the hospital. To stop the infected from breaking out of the building, an event that would have created an uncontrollable global pandemic, Church had his people burn down the entire hospital. Everyone who was inside, even those not yet infected, died. It was a horrible act of murder, but I went over all the footage, all the reports, every scrap of information, and concluded that there was no plan B. He did what he had to do to save the world. When I called him on it, he gave me the same look I was seeing here, and he said to me, "To stop this thing, I'd burn down heaven itself." I believed him too, then and by implication, now. "You said that there were helos in the air," I said. "Where do we stand with containment of information?" "Oh, hell," said Bug. "This is all over the net. People were uploading pics and video from their phones almost from the start. There were news choppers up there before the cops even arrived. They've been chased out and there's a no-fly zone now except for authorized birds, but that's closing the barn door." "The public does not know about the island of frogs, though," said Church. "We're still containing that, but expect that grace period to burn off soon. I've been on the phone with some of my associates, and they have been on the phones with all four heads of state. So far, we are keeping the punk press footage of the SEALs and ROK soldiers under wraps. That's one element of this we can control, for now, as long as punk press doesn't release it elsewhere. And so far, they have not."
"They will, though," said Doc. "You can count on them chickens."
"Add this to the math," I said, and told them about the conversation I had with Ho, where he hinted at making sure word about the drone never got out. That gave them a moment's pause. "Colonel Ho is a good man," said Church. "This squares with what I've heard about him. It's also a good suggestion." "If the drone is American," I said.
"And if that video doesn't get out," said Bug.
"Regardless of containment," I said, "Frog Island was an act of terrorism. I don't have a shred of doubt about that. Not one."
"But who are our bad boys?" asked Doc. "It's more than rogue SEALs, if that's even who they are, and it's more than drones. Somebody had the brights to cook up some new kind of pathogen. When's the last time you heard of Johnny Smar's bug hunters standing around scratching their heads? When's the last time you ran BAM's units in a hot zone and got jack and shit? No, campers. Somewhere in all this is an actual mad scientist, and I would dearly love for you and your crew of thugs to bring me his balls. Deep fried with some grated cheese."
"Count on it," I promised. "One final thing," said Church. "Because this second outbreak is on a South Korean island, I've agreed to have one of their officers join Havoc for the duration of this mission. She'll be waiting for you at Osan."
Interlude 13. Embassy Suites by Hilton, Fayetteville, Fort Bragg, 4760 Lake Valley Drive, Fayetteville, North Carolina, 6 months ago. Adam and Eve sat on the bed, eyes wide, attentive as school children. The curtains were drawn and there was an iPad playing a noisy football game with small Bluetooth speakers facing the door to the hall and the wall to the only adjoining room. It was the middle of the afternoon, in that gap between the last of the housekeeping rounds and when people in town for conventions returned to their room. The guest next door had been studied and was on day 2 of a 3-day presentation at Fort Bragg.
He wouldn't be back until well after 6, and later, if he went to another dinner on the base. There was no one to bother them, and the staff at the desk were wonderfully indifferent. Rafael Santoro stood by the dresser, carefully cleaning his tools and instruments and replacing them in their little fitted slots in the big leather case. It amazed Eve that Santoro had not gotten a single drop of blood on his clothing. Not one. The blood on the floor was all on the big plastic tarp, and on the man, who sat sweaty, panting, and defeated on the chair. The man's soft, fractured sobs were muffled by the ball gag he wore. His tears mingled with the blood, turning a pretty pink as it wandered down through the dense forest of his chest hair. Santoro took a small utility knife from the kit and sliced through the padded ropes that held the man to the chair. He cut them all and pulled out the ball gag and handed the man a towel.
"Thank you,"
mumbled the man. Adam and Eve exchanged a wide-eyed look. The man had thanked someone after everything that had been done, and worse, said to him.
"You may use the bathroom," Santoro said. "Wash thoroughly, shampoo your hair, use the toothbrush. There is antiseptic and some band-aids. You won't need many. Everything will heal. Nothing will leave a scar. If you are in much pain, there are some aspirin and a bottle of water on the sink. Your clothes are folded on the toilet tank."
Without saying another word, the man rose, naked and trembling, and shambled off to the bathroom. He was a large, muscular man with military tattoos and some scars earned in combat. He met no one's eyes. He looked down at the floor as if afraid it would drop out from under him. The door closed and they heard him vomiting, then a flush and the shower. They sat in silence. Adam and Eve held hands while Santoro finished packing up his equipment. He hiked himself onto the bureau and sat. He stared into the middle of nowhere. After 15 minutes, the big man came out of the bathroom dressed in his camouflage ACU pants and jacket, his cap in his hands. He lingered at the door, looking uncertainly at the three people without actually making eye contact.
"I..."
he began and faltered.
"No," said Santoro. "Just go. Remember our agreement and go. We're done here, yes?"
The man lingered for a moment, and Eve thought she could see the ghosts of his rage and pride and need to kill everyone in the room. Then his gaze crumpled, and he looked down at the hand he twisted between his trembling fingers. Without another word, he turned and walked out. The three of them looked at the closed door, then at the bloody and sweat-stained chair, then at each other.
"And that," said Santoro, "is how it's done. He will do exactly what we want, in the precise way we want it, and he will do it with all of his earnest diligence. He will, in fact, let nothing or no one get in his way."
"Won't he tell someone?"
gasped Adam. Santoro did not answer. He studied them both with his dark eyes. His irises were so dark brown they looked black, giving him a demonic cast.
"No," said Eve. "He won't. Because this isn't about what you did to him. It's about what we'll do to the people he thought he could protect, but now knows he can't."
"Clever girl,"
said Santoro. After a moment, Adam licked his lips.
"You weren't joking when you said extortion and coercion were art forms, that they were beautiful."
Santoro pushed off the bureau, walked over, and kissed them both on the head.
"There is so much more I want to teach you," he said with the gentle affection of a father. "There are so many gifts I want to share."
"Thanks," said Adam, nearly tripping on the word.
He was awkward, uncertain how to properly react. Until now, he and Eve had always been on their own,
making things up as they went, taking whatever they wanted from whomever they picked. Now, this strange man was trying to change that, to control them, to recruit them, to make them part of a system. He wanted to tell him thanks, but no thanks. Adam wanted to grab Eve and get the fuck out of there, to get off the grid and make damn sure they fell off the radar of this man and his organization. He wanted to... Eve stood up and put her arms around Santoro's waist and laid her head on his chest. She was smiling and there were tears in her eyes as she looked up at him.
"Thank you, Daddy,"
she said. Adam felt the floor of his stomach drop away and into the black hole beneath all of his hope and his resistance tumbled down into nothing. Into yesterday. This was what Eve wanted. This was the home she'd been looking for all her life. He got slowly to his feet and wrapped both Eve and Santoro in his arms.
"Yes," he said. "Thank you, Daddy."
Chapter 61. Osan Air Base near Songtan Station, Pyeongtaek, South Korea. We landed at Osan again, but this time Colonel Epps was a little less persnickety. Now it was a major outbreak that was all over the news, so he was able to take overt ownership. Havoc was still running under the cover story of a WHO hot zone team that just happened to be in the area. Epps's boss called us a lucky break and a godsend, whatever. Epps met us just beyond the rotor wash of the Chinook. We shook hands as we jogged away from the noise.
"We have the entire island quarantined," he said.
"Are there survivors?"
"We think so. Communications went down on the island about an hour after things started happening."
"How?"
I asked. "Well, that's still up for debate," said Epps. "We know that there are a number of fires burning out of control. No active infrastructure in place, no word at all from police or fire, no contact with the hospital. But I think there's another element in play. Seems pretty clear that something is actively jamming cell and radio communications. If that's the case, it's something high-tech, because it's interfering with some drones launched from the Chouyong, a Chungmugong-Yi Sunsin-class destroyer."
"Military-grade jammer?"
"Has to be, but it's weird," said Epps. "My people tell me that it's not stopping civilian radio or cell communication, but it's playing all kinds of games with the drones. Explain that to me."
"Targeted jamming," I said slowly. "Now that's interesting as all hell."
"We can do some of that," said Epps. "But not a lot of other countries can. China, Russia, maybe France, not too many others. We can beat most jamming attacks, but not this cocksucker."
"Shit. What about satellites? They should be well above any useful jamming range."
Epps rubbed his eyes. "They are considering retasking one, but you know how it is. Hard as hell to convince the CIA to shift eyes from the North Korean missile factories, and so far, no one further up the food chain knows about the other thing."
The other thing was the island of frogs.
"Understood," I said. "Okay, there's someone I need you to meet," said Epps, shifting gears.
He led me over to where a Korean woman dressed in unmarked black fatigues stood waiting. She was about 30 and unusually tall for a Korean, maybe 5'9".
"Outlaw," said Epps. "Allow me to introduce Major Mun Ji-woo."
Mun held out her hand, and when I took it, she gave me a very firm, very formal shake.
"Special Forces Brigade?" I ventured.
"Which unit?" There were 7 primary units within the ROK's Special Forces, but Mun shook her head.
"I am on special detachment from Kingdom," she said.
"Ah," I replied, and Epps looked a bit lost. Kingdom was a very special and highly secret organization that was similar in structure to Barrier and the old DMS. Small, elite, ruthless, and untethered by the red tape that grinds most military to a stumbling walk. "I had the honor of working with Taleo a few years ago," I said, and watched her eyes for a reaction. Taleo was the call sign for Captain Kim Dae-shim, who was one of the all-time great international special operators. Fierce, smart, and surprisingly funny. We took apart a North Korean factory that was developing DSRVs, deep sea remote vehicles, capable of delivering small nukes into industrial shipping ports or right in the middle of the Seventh Fleet. Taleo and I shook the pillars of heaven on that one, but then he was critically injured. I got him out and brought him home. However, he's a paraplegic. Still has that sense of humor, though. Sends me the most hilariously obscene Christmas cards. Major Munn's eyes were dark brown pieces of polished stone. Not a trace of emotion flickered in them. It was like looking into the eyes of a storm mannequin. Odd and a bit disconcerting.
Taleo is a great loss to my country, said Munn. I believe you were in the vicinity when he was injured?
He saved my life, I said.
Yes,
she said, and left it there, allowing me to infer what I wanted. Epps looked from me to Munn and back again, waiting for an explanation, got none, and sighed.
Your gear's over there, he said, pointing to a hulking Marine Corps MV-22B Osprey, a tilt-rotor vertical takeoff and landing bird that could punch along at over 300 miles per hour, fast and big enough to carry us and a lot of gear.
Thanks, I said, and turned to go, but Epps held out his hand.
Outlaw, is there anything I can do instead of sit here with my thumb up my ass?
Prayers would be useful, I said, and no, that's not a joke. Munn and I headed toward the Osprey.
Are we going to have some kind of problem, Major? I asked.
She walked three or four steps before she replied.
I respect your authority in this matter, Outlaw, she said.
But?
No buts. I will do my duty and serve my country.
That was the end of the conversation. We joined the others. The RTI logistics man, Brian Bird Dog Bird, was sitting on one of a small pile of equipment cases. He was drinking a Dr. Pepper and didn't look happy. Guess we weren't happy either. I introduced Munn to everyone and noted the brief mutual evaluation and instant dislike evident between her and Ho. They gave each other bows so tight I wondered that they didn't each tear their back muscles. Pretty sure if either was on fire, the other wouldn't spit on them to put it out. I stepped close to them and said, "Play nice," in a tone that was not nice at all. Ho looked embarrassed and mumbled something. Munn merely turned away. Bird Dog got up and offered his hand to Ho.
I heard about your sergeant, Colonel, said Bird Dog, in about the worst chopped-up Korean I've ever heard. Even Ho looked confused and asked him to repeat it in English. Hope he's okay.
Thank you, he said.
Bird Dog handed out new comms kits and caught my eye before giving one to Munn.
Going to need a combat call sign so I can wire her into the network, he said, giving her an almost apologetic smile.
We can pick one for you if... I have one already, said Munn. Mudang.
I smiled and nodded, and she cocked an eyebrow.
You know what that is?
A female shaman.
Very good,
she said in a way that was supposed to be complimentary but sounded very condescending. Top cleared his throat and made introductions to everyone else using only call signs. We all put on the comms units, which consisted of the tiny mole-sized earbuds and mics, and little power packs that were about the size of six stacked quarters. Then Havoc Team boarded the Osprey. We were in the air in under 2 minutes. Once we were on our way, Bird Dog opened a big equipment case and began handing out hammer suits. We stripped to our skivvies despite the cold December breeze and pulled on the suits. If Ho or Munn were uncomfortable changing in front of everyone, they kept it off their faces. Points for them. Once we were suited up, Bird Dog began opening weapons cases.
Okay, kids, he said, flipping open two identical boxes. All the weapons are pretty much generic to the mercenary community, and that's still the cover. Pick your handguns and long guns of choice.
I smiled and took a Heckler & Koch G36, which I was very familiar with from my days with the Baltimore PD. It was our assault rifle of choice. And there was a modified Navy Colt 1911 Model 45, an old favorite. Then Bird Dog opened a long case marked with a stenciled image of a horse. Inside were a variety of weapons with bright blue handles.
What are those? Asked Munn.
Bird Dog lifted out a pistol.
This is a Snellig 22A Max gas dart gun, proprietary tech.
has very high compression for decent range and solid hits. Will penetrate most clothes except leather or heavy denim. Long internal barrel for accuracy. The guns were about the same dimensions as a Colt M45, but half the weight even with extended 30-shot box magazines. Mags are loaded with gelatin darts filled with a nifty new cocktail of goodies built around the veterinary drug ketamine, but with a little bit of BZ to cause intense confusion and DMHP for muscle weakness so bad, victims have trouble standing upright. Also, some benzodiazepines and chlorohydrate and some other stuff that Doc Holliday calls Brand X, meaning you don't need to know what it is. We call it Sandman. One dart will put anyone up to, and including Bigfoot, on his ass right damn now. No one shakes it off, so don't stick yourself. You go down and go out, and the psychoactive compounds will give you some peculiar dreams. Goofy over there accidentally shot Pluto. He waved to his two burly assistants. Goofy and Pluto were not their official combat call signs, but Bird Dog refused to call them anything else. Pluto went down and had very intense sexual dreams about a talking cantaloupe.
True story, said Pluto dryly. It was great. Very sexy melon. We bonded.
It was awesome, agreed Goofy. He and Pluto exchanged a fist bump. They looked like a pair of mouth-breathing Neanderthals, but weren't. They did enjoy playing those roles, though.
Who is Doc Holliday? Asked Munn.
She's the head of our Integrated Sciences Division, I said.
Would that be Joan Holliday, formerly of DARPA?
It would. Munn's expression was unreadable, though a bit unpleasant.
Does that mean you are still tied to the United States government?
No, it does not, I said.
Why do I find that hard to believe?
Why do I not give a shit about what you believe? I countered. Colonel Ho cleared his throat, then took the magazine from Bird Dog, removed a dart very carefully, and studied it.
Is there any chance you could share the formula with me?
Sure there's a chance, said Bird Dog with a smile. There's two chances, actually, and they are slim and none.
Ah.
I said, Doc Holliday suggested these non-lethal rounds, and I'm all for it. These are civilians infected with something, and the world is watching. We want to contain the situation so that we can study it and offer aid.
What if there's no cure for whatever this is?
Asked Munn. Ho turned slowly to face her.
We have no proof of that, Major. We only have one living infected right now, and he is my sergeant. Are you suggesting we simply kill everyone who is infected?
She was unmoved.
I'm asking about the rules of engagement. What if these darts don't stop them?
They will, said Bird Dog. Not joking when I said that you don't shake one off. You get hit, you go down. All you need is a central nervous system and a circulatory system.
Fine,
she snapped.
Then what are we expected to do if we're facing too many to be stopped by drugs?
If we can't fall back to safety or otherwise control the situation, I said, then we do what we have to, but the point is to establish and maintain control.
Hurrah,
said Top very softly. Munn's eyes locked on mine for a moment and then flicked away. She bent and took a Glock 17 from the first case.
I'll keep that in mind,
she said.
That killed conversation for the moment, so everyone simply began selecting weapons and stuffing as much ammunition into their belt and pouches as they could.
Everyone took a lot of it. Bird Dog scowled at us. You do know this stuff's expensive, right? I mean, I have to budget all this crap out. Suits, weapons, bird drones, all that. You have any idea at all what my accounting nightmares are?
Top slapped a magazine into his pistol, and the barrel almost, but not quite, pointed at Bird Dog's crotch. He said nothing. Bird Dog sighed.
You make a compelling argument.
The chopper flew on, taking Havoc Team toward another island filled with death.
Chapter 62. Hotel Ryumeikan, Tokyo, Japan. When the phone rang, Eve actually screamed. She also peed a little in her pajamas. Adam flung himself forward to grab the burner phone on the nightstand, clumsied the grab and overcompensated trying to catch the cell as it slid out of reach. The phone, the lamp, the nightstand, and Adam all crashed to the floor. He cursed as his elbow struck hard, despite the carpet, but he snatched up the phone and hit the button.
Yes? Line? Clear.
The scrambler was already jacked into the charging port, the small light glowing green.
We're good.
What's wrong?
Asked the caller suspiciously.
You sound out of breath.
I was doing push-ups.
There was a beat.
Whatever,
said Rafael Santoro.
Are you ready to act?
Absolutely,
swore Adam. He glanced up at Eve, who was peering over the edge of the bed like a frightened child checking for scary, leering clowns under her bed.
Are you sure? I'm not hearing confidence in your tone, boy.
Adam drew in a steadying breath and in a more confident-sounding voice said,
Yes, Daddy, I'm positive. We're ready to do anything you need. Then I need you to do this.
Santoro quickly explained what he wanted done.
Sure,
said Adam.
That's easy. It'll take just a little time. I need to go to the storage locker and get my other laptop. It has the video editing software. Do it. Make it convincing, yes?
Yes, certainly. Absolutely, you can count on us, Daddy.
Then there is a second task for you.
Anything.
Clean up the back trail on this. Be thorough.
No problem, Daddy.
And one more thing,
said Santoro.
Yes?
Don't call me Daddy.
The line went dead, and Adam sagged back against the carpet, exhaling slowly. Eve slithered like a nervous reptile off the bed and curled against him. He could feel her heart beating as fast as his own.
Is he mad at us?
She asked in a tiny voice. Adam took a moment with that.
No. You're sure?
Yes, he said. If he was really mad, he wouldn't have called. He'd have knocked.
Chapter 63. Arclight Safe House, Gyeongsang Namdo, South Korea. Lieutenant Han was as good as her billing. She had her men take them to a small house that did not belong to the military, nor, as it developed, did she or her guards. Everything about them was a very clever fraud intended to smooth things at the airport.
We are all in this system, though,
she explained.
If anyone checks, they will find unshakable identification and histories. We officially belong to Department 81, which is an ultra-secret investigative group that really exists.
I know about D-81.
Said Bug.
I helped set that up 7 or 8 years ago, before Kingdom was created. We needed DMS teams to be able to operate in-country with the appearance of approval from so high, no one would ever risk the career backlash to question it.
That was you?
Han gazed at him with pure love in her eyes.
I should have known. Who else could have made something like that? The structure of misdirection and obfuscation is so... So?
She fished for the right word and couldn't find one juicy enough.
Okay, you really need to stop that,
said Bug.
Why?
She asked with such frankness that it gave Bug nowhere to go. And he suddenly wondered if the fangirl thing was a trick to keep him off balance. Probably. If so, it made him like her a whole lot more. He cleared his throat and began unpacking his gear.
Arclight uses this place now,
she said.
And those two guys? I didn't know Arclight had any men working for them.
She shrugged.
Allies. Not all guys are assholes.
Kind of have to agree.
They set up at a big kitchen table. The fridge was filled with Red Bull and the cabinets stuffed with junk food. One of the allies came back in 20 minutes with pizza and soda, left it on the table, nodded, and went out. Neither man had so far said a word. Han had several monitors set up on a network, and they watched the punk press video a couple of times, then went through the information set aside as definitely or possibly pertaining to the case. She had an Oracle substation, and Bug had a mind reader Q1 remote field unit. Han stared at it with naked lust.
That's the actual quantum system, isn't it?
She whispered.
Kind of. Did you marry it to Mind Reader?
You know about Mind Reader?
Mother Lilith told me.
Mother Lilith. Bug shivered. Violin was, as far as he knew, Lilith's only biological daughter, but Lilith was the head of the Mothers of the Fallen, of which Arclight was the militant arm. There was something odd, though, in hearing her called Mother with actual affectation. Bug knew that the stories told about Lilith, about the things she and the other senior Arclight women had done to the men they hunted, were all true. All of them. Although Bug knew that Church was probably the single most dangerous person on Earth, it was Lilith who actually scared him. At the same time, he had an admiration for her that ran miles and miles deep. It was so damn sad that the world needed women like her and the mothers. It was worse that things like human trafficking and slavery were happening in greater numbers now than ever in history. Ever. He cut a covert look at Han, who did not look like the kind of damaged, lethal, righteous warrior he'd come to expect of the Arclight members. It made him wonder what kinds of scars were beneath the glowing eyes, luminous smile, and peppy attitude. They got to work. As with the former DMS, the RTI used nicknames for these cases, and this one was given the obvious name of Rage. Bug went through the steps he'd taken to try and crack apart the source of the punk press emails. Han had a lot of very good ideas, and she knew the local networks, the tech specs for this part of Korea, and had insight into the fringe culture. She was also very, very good at slicing her way through rerouting programs.
No one uses that software more than sex traffickers, she said, especially the ones who sell kiddie porn to European and American customers. It's mostly dark web stuff, but they have to do some stuff on the regular web, and that leaves a footprint, if you know how to track them.
She sat back and smiled, like a kid who'd cracked the hardest level of the latest God of War game.
Gotcha, you bastard.
What? Asked Bug, bending forward eagerly.
This is where it was sent from, she said.
Bug frowned at the information on the screen.
Wait, a dinosaur museum?
Chapter 64. In Flight, South Korea. I sat in the back of the chopper and watched Havoc Team go through the process of becoming acclimated to their new teammate. I also watched the individual dynamics of Colonel Ho and Major Mun. It was interesting theater. According to every stereotypical viewpoint, Ho should have been the cold, detached political animal using every opportunity to spout catchphrases from party doctrine. That was the cliche, but Ho was a kind and rather gentle man, a healer, and seemed comfortable with his own thoughts. My guys liked him, and they're hard sells. Mun, on the other hand, sat apart and kept her thoughts and her comments to herself. The big rock heads on Easter Island were chattier and more human. There was no time for a quiet chat before suiting up, so I had no idea if her attitude was because she was forced to work with someone from the north or because he was a higher rank, though I doubted anyone in a crisis would be that petty. That left me with no other avenues of speculation. So, I moved my comms mic closer to my mouth, cycled over to the talk channel, and made a discreet call.
What do we know about the new kid in school? I asked. Scott Wilson seemed to be anticipating the call.
She's absolutely top of the line, outlaw. He ran down her credentials as a first-class officer whose rise through the ranks was meteoric. Enough medals and commendations to fill a wall. She is fifth-generation military, seen action all over the world, first with the ROK, and then as the first active field operator in Kingdom. If they ever cut her loose, she's high on our list.
Uh-huh, I said, unconvinced.
Psych profile? It's solid, no issues. Devoted to her family. Oldest of three sisters, parents and grandparents still alive. Father, mother, uncle, and grandfather are all military, all served or are serving with distinction. Uses her leave to go home for holidays. Is godmother to her twin nieces.
I stared across the cabin at her and tried to square what I was hearing with the Iron Maiden sitting like a vulture in the farthest corner. Her face was a stone, and her eyes clicked from one person to another and then out the window. Mr. Spock is 10 times more gregarious. It was truly like looking at a robot.
No, that wasn't quite right. I could see the muscles along her jaw clearly defined as she sat there, clenched and tight, clamping it down, keeping it in. But what was she fighting to control?
Dig deeper, I said.
Why? Asked Wilson. Is something wrong?
That's what I need you to tell me. I signed off and tried not to be seen watching her, pretty sure she was doing exactly the same thing.
Interlude 14. Wildlife Road above the Point Doom Bluffs, Malibu, California, 9 months ago.
We should not linger so long in one place, said Santoro.
He stood in the sunlight, naked to the waist, glistening with sweat, chest heaving from exertion, but his eyes calm. The yard was large, with trees and tall fences providing excellent cover from distant neighbors. A tiled patio stretched outward from an indoor gym accessed by a section of wall that opened like a garage door. It provided Santoro with 5,000 square feet of training area. Several men and women, all of them equally sweaty and some of them badly bruised, were working through yet another set of demanding drills. Santoro was a brutal taskmaster. He set very high standards, exceeded those in demonstration, and then encouraged his students to aspire toward excelling him. None did, but many were getting close, which made him very happy. Kuga, in white shorts and an open tropical shirt, lay on a chaise longue, a bourbon sour balanced on his taut stomach, watching, always watching.
Did you hear what I said? Asked Santoro.
Sure.
And?
And you're right, said Kuga. In fact, I have a truck coming tomorrow to take some things down to L.A.
Santoro frowned.
We're moving to the city?
L.A.? God, no. Place is a cesspit. I should have specified. Our stuff's going to be loaded onto a boat. I have a 101-meter motor yacht, a Roberto Curto that was made in a joint venture with RC Design.